The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 21st, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The drawing on the cover this week shows Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. They are sitting in a booth at an old-style diner. The table and the seat backs are kind of a pinkish color and a light blue. And they are looks like they're sharing an ice cream soda, sitting in the middle of the table, and they've each got a straw, and they're just having a good time and smiling fondly at each other. The title on the cover is A Real Connection. Even as the scandal grows, why does Trump treat Putin like an ally? Well, let's find out in the main stories and how they were covered. Trump Jr.'s secret meeting with a Russian lawyer. What happened? In a bombshell revelation that left the White House deeply rattled, President Donald Trump's eldest son admitted this week that he met with a Kremlin-linked lawyer last year after being promised she had very high-level and sensitive information that would incriminate Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump Jr. was told in an email by British publicist Rob Goldstone, an intermediary he knew from his father's Miss Universe pageant in Moscow, that the proposal was part of Russia and its government's support for his father. "If it's what you say," Trump Jr. replied, "I love it." He forwarded the email chain to his brother-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his father's campaign manager, Paul Manafort. All three men met the lawyer, Natalia Vasilnitskaya, in Trump Tower on June 9, 2016. Trump Jr., who now runs the family business, initially claimed this week that the meeting was about an adoption program that was ended by the Kremlin in response to U.S. sanctions. But when the New York Times then revealed that email showed he had in fact thought the meeting would yield dirt on Clinton, Trump Jr. claimed Vasilnitskaya had not provided anything of substance, released the email chain himself, and insisted he never told his father about the offer of Russian government's help. The president, who was reportedly deeply frustrated that the Russia story just wouldn't go away, said that his son is a high-quality person who is open, transparent, and innocent. The Trump Jr. revelations came just days after President Trump's first face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Hamburg. After the two-hour conversation, Putin said Trump had accepted his assurances that there was no Russian meddling in the election. The White House disputed that account, saying Trump had strongly pressed Putin on the issue, but agreed that it was time to move forward. Trump also said he and Putin made important progress on a ceasefire in Syria and that they were planning to jointly set up an impenetrable cybersecurity unit, a claim he later dropped amid widespread ridicule. What the editorial said. The Trump Jr. emails confirm what the president, his son, and others have denied repeatedly for more than a year, said the New York Times. Trump campaign officials met with Russian government representatives to solicit help in winning the election. Any halfway competent and ethical campaign would have taken a foreign government's offer to influence a U.S. election straight to the FBI. Instead, Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner pounced on it. Now Trump Jr. appears to be in real legal jeopardy for violating campaign law prohibitions on soliciting anything of value from foreign officials. The decision to meet with Vasilnitskaya was disgraceful, said NationalReview.com, but it doesn't prove that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. It's plausible that Goldstone deliberately misled Trump Jr. about having dirt on Clinton in order to get Vasilnitskaya through the door to lobby for lifting sanctions, and that nothing else came of it. But it would be easier to credit the Trump team's denials if they didn't so routinely mislead. Trump Jr. changed his story multiple times, and Kushner initially failed to disclose the meeting during his security clearance application process. The public needs a full investigation into what happened between Trump and Russia, now more than ever. What the columnist said. U.S. intelligence agencies told us that Putin's goal was to get Trump in the White House, said Christian Farias in NYMag.com. But for the first time, we have clear evidence, a smoking gun, of improper connections between Russia and Trump's inner circle. This revelation may point to wrongdoing that could very well reach the president himself, who began publicly inviting Russia to find and publish Clinton's emails right after his son's meeting. Is it really credible that Trump's son, son-in-law, and campaign manager were told that the Russian government wanted to give Trump information to help him beat Clinton and never mentioned it to the candidate? Sorry, but this is a faux scandal, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. There are always people hovering around campaigns trying to peddle information. Trump Jr. was foolish to take the meeting. He should have sent a lackey. But since nothing happened, no collusion occurred. If, as Trump defenders insist, the Trump-Russia connection is all a big nothing burger, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com, why does Trump keep acting as if Putin is his favorite world leader? Virtually everyone else in Congress and Trump's cabinet sees Putin as a dangerous foe who interfered in our election. But the president remains firmly attached to the idea of a Russia-friendly foreign policy. Why? What I don't understand, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com, is how conservatives can mock, scoff at, and ridicule the idea that there might be legs to this story. Trump fired the FBI director and told both the Russian ambassador and a national TV audience he did so to thwart the Russia investigation. Both his son and son-in-law have had multiple secretive contacts with Russian bankers, oligarchs, and Putin allies. Every time the Trump apologists go out on a limb to defend him, the president brings out the saw. Our controversy of the week, Trump, an unapologetic defense of Western civilization. President Trump put his worldview on display before meeting with G20 leaders last week, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com, and it's dripping with racial and religious paranoia. On a side trip to Warsaw, Poland, Trump delivered an alarming defense of Western civilization of a kind never heard from a U.S. president. He spoke not as the elected leader of a multicultural, heterogeneous nation, but as the head of a tribe. In a thinly veiled reference to the Islamic world and to other non-white, non-Christian nations, Trump warned of forces from the South or the East that threaten to erase the bonds of culture, faith, and tradition that make us who we are. In the speech's most shocking sentence, the president said that the fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. This only makes sense if you see non-white, non-Christian immigrants as invaders and an existential threat. Tellingly, Trump's defense of Western values contained no mention of human rights and just one reference to democracy, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com. It was also no accident that he chose to expound on white grievance politics in Poland, whose right-wing ruling party is strongly nationalistic and anti-immigrant and has aggressively sought to curb the independence of the country's judiciary and media. That's nonsense on stilts, said John O'Sullivan in NationalReview.com. American leftists who swooned over Barack Obama's post-national globalism obviously found Trump's speech horrifying. But it was an unabashed celebration of Western culture and values at a moment in history when those values are under concerted attack. Trump's critics are upset that he promised the West will prevail against radical Islamic terrorism, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com, as if such bellicose rhetoric were unnecessarily divisive. But shouldn't we want Western values of pluralism and liberty to prevail over Islamism? Some cultural relativists, apparently, find it offensive to suggest that some long-dead white guys might have had some good ideas about civilization. What does Donald Trump know about Western values, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. This is a president who admits he reads no books and clearly knows nothing of history or art. He denounces the journalists exercising freedom of the press as enemies of the people, disdains the rule of law, and is visibly more comfortable with authoritarians like Saudi Arabia's King Salman and Russia's Vladimir Putin than he is with democratically elected leaders from Western Europe. In his speech, Trump dared to speak of our own fight for the West, yet he's alienated our allies with boorish behavior and his withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords. His primary foreign policy objective seems to be to smash the unity of the Western alliance. Trump's critics are right about one thing, said David French in NationalReview.com. He did sharply disagree with George W. Bush's contention that God has planted in every human heart the desire to live in freedom, and with Obama's insistence that the longing for freedom and human dignity is not English or American or Western. In that naive faith, our previous presidents have been wrong, dangerously wrong. As horrific events in the Middle East and other continents have shown, a belief in individual liberty, religious freedom, tolerance, and democracy is not universal. Trump may be an imperfect vessel for this message, but he's right. The ideas that define and govern our nation come from a specific culture which is uniquely valuable and vulnerable and needs to be protected. That's not racism. That's just truth. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week shorts. It was a good week for Crazy Micah and Psycho Joe after MSNBC's Morning Joe saw a huge rating spike in the wake of President Trump's Twitter attack mocking the program and its hosts, Micah Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. Viewership increased by 66% in the week following the president's tweets. It was a good week for trickle-down economics after a Princeton survey revealed that male Republicans are the best tippers, while women and Democrats left a median gratuity of 15 to 16%, Republican men were more likely to leave an average of 20%. And it was a good week for slobs after University of Minnesota researchers found that keeping a messy desk may be a sign of creative genius. Disorderly environments seem to inspire breaking free of tradition, the researchers concluded, which can produce fresh insights. But it was a bad week for hubris. After New Jersey Governor Chris Christie saw his approval ratings plummet to a record low of 15%, after he was photographed lounging with his family on a state beach that he had closed to the public over a budget impasse. It was a bad week for modernity, after female reporters with bare shoulders and open-toed shoes were barred from entering the House of Representatives lobby because of a dress code ban on inappropriate attire. And finally, it was a bad week for wildlife encounters, after a 19-year-old Colorado camp counselor sleeping outdoors woke up to a crunching sound and found a black bear chomping on his head. The crunching noise, I guess, was the teeth scraping against his skull, said the teen, who punched the bear and escaped with minor injuries. And before we move on from this page, a boring but important article, Ethics Chief Quits. The director of the Office of Government Ethics resigned from his job last week, nearly 6 months before the end of his term, saying that his interactions with the Trump administration had been a disappointment. Walter Schaub Jr. had clashed with President Trump's team several times over the past few months as he urged Trump to fully divest from his business empire. In January, days before Trump's inauguration, incoming White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus warned Schaub that he was becoming extremely political, a comment Schaub took as a fairly explicit threat, he said. Schaub said he wasn't leaving under pressure from the White House, but felt there isn't more I could accomplish in this administration. Moving on to the briefing page, the title this week is Congo's Forgotten War. A brutal civil war in Congo has displaced more people in the past year than the wars in Syria and Iraq. Who's fighting? What is happening? A political crisis that has simmered for decades has exploded into a new civil war, engulfing south-central Congo in mass butchery and chaos. Since October, at least 3,400 people have been killed in the Kasai region, and in such gruesome ways that more than 1.3 million people have fled their homes in terror. My team saw children as young as two whose limbs had been chopped off, said UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein. Many babies had machete wounds and severe burns. The government of President Joseph Kabila appears to be behind some of the atrocities. After the rebel faction Kamuina Inspo rose up last fall against Kabila's government, both the Congolese army and the rebels engaged in atrocities. But the most horrific acts in recent months have been the work of a new militia, Banamura, which the UN says was created and armed by Kabila's government. Banamura militants of a different ethnic group than the Kamuina Sapu have slaughtered whole villages, going door to door and killing everyone they found, babies, parents, grandparents. What prompted the uprising? Kasai province is dominated by opponents of the government in Kinshasa. Last summer, the government appointed Kabila loyalists to key local posts rather than Kasai's tribal chiefs. Local leader Kamuina Sapu, convicted diamond trafficker, led an uprising with a militia named after him and composed largely of children and teens. government soldiers killed Sapu last August, but his fanatical militia began attacking government buildings, and the Congolese military fought back with unchecked brutality. The UN has more than 20,000 peacekeepers in Congo, but they are based mostly in the east of the vast country, and so far they have not intervened in the Kasai conflict. Why are the peacekeepers there? Congo has been a violent, unstable nation ever since the 1994 genocide of neighboring Rwanda. In that civil war, Hutus slaughtered Tutsis en masse, killing some 800,000 people in 3 months. Later, defeated Hutu fighters fled to Congo, then known as Zaire, where the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko gave them sanctuary. Angered by the Hutus' continued attacks, Rwanda invaded Congo and helped guerrilla Laurent Kabila overthrow Mobutu in 1997. But within a year, Kabila had fallen out with his patrons. In 1998, Rwanda invaded Congo again, and the turmoil drew in five other countries battling for control of Congo's vast mineral wealth. The conflict known as Africa's World War formally ended in 2003 after some 5 million people were dead, mostly of disease and famine. Laurent Kabila was assassinated, and his son Joseph succeeded him as president, but has failed to consolidate control over the Central African nation, which is nearly as large as all of Western Europe. What is Kabila's agenda? Joseph Kabila and his cronies have grown massively rich by looting the state and accepting bribes from foreign mining companies. While Kabila's second and final term as president ended in December, he refused to leave office, saying the country was too volatile. He postponed the elections until late 2017. Some Congolese opposition fighters believe that Kabila is encouraging the violence so he can again say the country is too unstable to hold that vote. As accusations grow that Kabila is behind Banamura, he has been expelling journalists and inspectors. In March, two UN monitors were investigating Congolese army culpability in political violence were murdered. Is the U.S. involved? Not directly, but U.S. companies are. Impoverished Congo has $24 trillion worth of mineral wealth in the ground, including cobalt, diamonds, gold, and coltan, a highly valuable ore containing the heat-resistant element tantalum, used to make the circuit boards in smartphones, laptops, and other electronic devices. The proceeds, often made off child labor, fund the rebel factions and the Congolese military, much as blood diamonds did in Sierra Leone. U.S. companies participate indirectly by buying tantalum and circuit boards and directly by investing in Congolese mining. Just last year, U.S. hedge fund Ochziff Capital Management was hit with a record fine of $412 million for bribing Kabila for mineral concessions. Could the fighting spread? Congo borders nine other countries, and last time it had a major civil war, just 14 years ago, it drew in the entire region. This time, the fear is that the massive displacement of people could spur other countries to intervene in an attempt to prevent a refugee exodus. While most of the 1.3 million people displaced so far have remained within Congo, at least 30,000 have already fled south to neighboring Angola. Neighboring countries also fear the disease outbreaks that often occur among large groups of people in refugee camps. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and nine former African presidents are warning in an urgent appeal that Congo's future is in grave danger. But so far, the world has declined to intervene. We'll be right back. And it's time to read a few of the best columns of the week. The first two we'll take from the U.S. Healthcare markets can't be free. If you want a free market healthcare system, said emergency room physician Farzan Navi, you must be willing to let some patients die. House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republicans who advocate giving people the freedom not to be covered in any way are promoting a big lie. In our society, healthcare is not an optional consumer good that people can choose to turn down. Every day, badly injured or dying patients arrive in my hospital who have no insurance. Some are unconscious. Later, they sometimes express dismay that we saved them because they know they've run up bills of tens of thousands of dollars. One man we saved from a brain bleed told me that he'd rather have died and left his family his life insurance payment than have burdened them with a massive medical bill and bankruptcy. Someone winds up paying for uncompensated care, whether it's the hospitals legally obligated to provide it or the taxpayers who subsidize it. Deep down inside, we all intuitively know that health care is not a free market. If you want true freedom, you have to be willing to let uninsured people found lying unconscious in the street remain there and die. Reversing the tide on immigration. President Trump will never be mistaken for a master of the sweet art of persuasion, said Rich Lowry, but he is clearly winning the public argument on the issue of immigration. When Trump promised during his presidential campaign to crack down on illegal immigration and ratchet up deportations, he ran directly into the teeth of the elite consensus, which included not only Democrats, but also moderate Republicans. But the immigration issue played a critical role in Trump's stunning election victory, and he's had great success in reducing the number of people trying to cross the border. Those realities have left many center-left intellectuals calling on Democrats to reconsider their absolutist support for both legal and illegal immigration. In recent weeks, liberal columnists such as Fareed Zakaria and Peter Beinart have written that U.S. policy should take account of the economic costs as well as the benefits of immigration. In an even greater heresy, liberal academic Jeff Colgan has acknowledged that it is not bigotry to calibrate immigration levels to the ability of immigrants to assimilate. If Democrats do recalibrate on immigration, the unlikely instrument of the sea change would be none other than Donald J. Trump. And this is a How They See Us article from Europe. America's declining global leadership. Donald Trump has now proved that he has neither the desire nor the capacity to lead the world, said Chris Ullman in abc.net.au from Australia. At the G20 summit in Hamburg last week, where the world's leading nations came together to reaffirm their mutual commitments to free trade and combating climate change, Trump was the surly outsider, eschewing both causes. He failed even to mention the one issue the other leaders would have backed him on, condemning North Korea's recent intercontinental ballistic missile test. The American president clearly has no convictions. He craves power because it burnishes his celebrity, and he barks out bile in 140 characters instead of promoting democracy and what used to be American values. He shunned U.S. allies and drooled all over President Vladimir Putin. Trump has now ceded global leadership to China and Russia, two authoritarian states that will forge a very different set of rules for the 21st century. It could have been worse, said Klaus-Dieter Frankenberger in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung from Germany. Trump didn't storm out of any meetings in a fit of pique, and the G20 managed to issue a final statement that upheld free trade, albeit with a caveat about the importance of national interests. Sure, Trump may be naive in his approach to Putin, but probably no more so than was George W. Bush, who claimed to have a rapport with the Russian president. At least Trump got Putin to agree to a partial armistice in Syria. At this point, the world's expectations of Trump are low. Europe has resigned itself to looking to German Chancellor Angela Merkel for reliable leadership. Trump himself considered his visit a success, said Mark Pitsky in Der Spiegel in Germany. His take can be summed up by that ridiculous video he tweeted, a mashup of theatrical, content-free scenes and gestures showing him with other world leaders. It was a bit of propaganda aimed only at his nationalistic conservative base. They don't know or care that Trump is making the U.S. isolated, shunned, and even pitied. Americans may actually believe what Trump said in his apocalyptic speech in Warsaw ahead of the G20 summit, said Walter Shapiro in The Guardian from UK. Trump railed against Islamist extremists, using racist dog whistles like Western values and civilization, which are code for white and Christian. He seems to revel in the concept of a holy war. The word missing from Trump's speech was democracy, said Jarosław Kuski in Gazeta Wyborska from Poland. In the dark days of communism, America's message to Poland was always freedom and democracy, the rule of law, and independent media. Now that our increasingly authoritarian right-wing government has put all those pillars of freedom once again under assault, we turned in vain to the American leader to remind us what to aim for. Trump failed us, and his America is failing the world. And it's time for our in-depth article, The Last Word, this week titled, What a Crow Knows. Crows are incredibly clever birds, capable of using tools and recognizing faces, said writer James Ross Gardner. Researchers have even found that crows mourn their dead and hold funerals. On a blustery, overcast morning this past April, Kaylee Swift walked across the campus of the University of Washington toting a weathered purple and white plastic shopping bag. This bag, if found by some unsuspecting student or groundskeeper, would almost certainly trigger a campus-wide panic. Inside, Swift had stowed a rubber mask of a grotesque, exaggerated male face, large ears, bulbous nose, silver-whiskered soul patch, a guise that would not look out of place in a 1980s horror film. Also inside, a corpse. That the corpse was only that of a bird didn't make the tattered bag's combined payload any less creepy. She tromped through the wet grass in her calf-high sorrel snow boots and made her way to the university's Center for Urban Horticulture, where she's a teaching assistant for an undergraduate natural history class. Near the dumpsters and trash cans parked behind the center, Swift found a perfect spot for what she was about to do: perform a ritual that, depending on how you look at it, is a couple of years old or a couple million. Swift, a PhD candidate, is a member of UW's nationally acclaimed Avian Conservation Lab. If you've heard or read a news story in the past decade about Corvus brachyrhynchus, a.k.a. the American crow, and what science has to say about its confounding habits and aptitude, there's a good chance it was thanks to the work conducted by the lab, which is led by a man named John Marsluff. The UW professor and wildlife biologist is the author of numerous popular books on the subject. In 2008, Marsluff and his fellow researchers made national headlines when they tested a hypothesis that crows recognize individual human faces by donning Dick Cheney masks. That led to another revelation. Crows teach other crows to detest specific people and sometimes attack them. Today, Swift 30 would repeat an experiment that uncovered one of the team's more staggering revelations, and she conducted it with the ceremony of an undertaker. From the old shopping bag, she unsheathed the dead crow and turned it in what little sunshine strained through the fibrous clouds. The black feathers sparkled in the light, and close inspection revealed iridescent blues and purples. She covered it back up with a tan cloth, and with the draped bird lying breast down on her two upturned palms, stepped gingerly into a patch of grass. She tore the linen away and unveiled the corpse to the gray heavens. There was nothing at first, just an empty sky. Then a caw. A crow appeared on a nearby power line. Then another caw and another crow. Suddenly, crows flew in from all directions. Their plaintive cries soon combined into a chorus. New arrivals joined what quickly grew into a cacophonous dervish of black silhouettes swirling directly above Swift. It was like sorcery, conjuring dozens of birds from thin air by simply removing fabric from a body. This, according to Swift, is what it's like to attend a crow funeral, an instinctive ritual that evolved generations ago and was just discovered by humans. Swift co-authored an article on her findings in the journal Animal Behavior in 2015. The gist, upon spotting one of its dead, the flock attends to the fallen bird in mass with loud shrieking. Giving enough time, the throng will mob any predator it thinks is responsible, like, say, a human in a Dick Cheney mask, or in a mask like the one Swift had in her bag. The lab affectionately refers to that besold-patched fellow as Joe. Because she had decided to leave Joe out of today's repeat of a groundbreaking experiment, she had to take precautions. Early during the gathering tsunami of sound, once the crows became particularly agitated, Swift pulled the hood of her rain jacket over her face, lest the birds, days later, recognize that face. When I came to Seattle, it was pretty obvious that the corvid of the day here was the crow, Marsliff told me recently. He was hired away from Boise State by the University of Washington in 1997 to teach and to study corvids, the family to which crows belong. Jays, ravens, and magpies are also corvids. Marsliff narrowed his focus once he observed just how many American crows lived and thrived in Seattle. The city's rapid growth and unique geography, it's essentially a forest squeezed between two bodies of water, are key to that large crow population. Forests aren't ideal for crow life, but over the past century, we've carved and opened up these areas for our suburbs and provided a constant food source, namely, abundant edible trash. We've created what Marsliff calls a mecca for crows. What's more, due to the constant exposure to urbanites, crows here are virtually unafraid of humans. In the countryside, there are hunting seasons on crows, Marsliff says, and farmers harass and shoot them to protect their crops. In the city, we either ignore them, feed them, or turn them into icons. Either way, crows here are cued into our daily rhythms and feel safe among us. That's certainly the case on the campus of the University of Washington, where up to 78,000 students, faculty, and staff spend their days. An early challenge for Marsliff, as he and his colleagues got the lab started, was capturing the campus fowl. They're not afraid of us, but that doesn't mean they like being nabbed. The team first tried a complicated makeshift trap involving a pizza box, leg nooses, and a weight. Later and more successfully, they employed net guns to envelop the birds whole. As they apprehended each crow, the researchers placed a color-coded band on one of its feet in order to tell the birds apart and then set it free. This opened a portal into crow life, permitting researchers access to what felt like another dimension, the crow's dimension. "We were watching to see what they eat," Marsliff recalls, "and basically they will eat anything, and they will try everything. The birds would, for example, loiter around garbage cans and wait for a squirrel to squirm into a can and pop back out with food. The crows would mob that squirrel and steal its lunch. I remember one time seeing them eat vomit off the side of a wall," Marsliff said. "You just go, wow, really? But they're very opportunistic, and they make do with just about any scrap in the city you can imagine." He details the bird's resourcefulness and ingenuity in a 2012 book he co-authored, Gifts of the Crow, How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. In it, we learn that not only do birds recognize human faces and hold grudges for human misdeeds, but they also teach other birds to recognize grudge-worthy mugs. Fledglings, for example, watch their parents mistreated, hear the calling associated with it, and learn to despise that human in the same way. On the other hand, Marsliff writes, crows show great appreciation for humans who treat them well. Gifts left behind are intended to court or impress people important in a crow's life. These gifts have been known to include candy, keys, and coins. She was 8 years old when she had trouble reading. The Spokane Elementary School she attended in the mid-1990s wanted to hold her back a grade. Was something wrong with her? Sometimes she wondered. The pediatrician had her on Ritalin. She hated Ritalin. It left her feeling separate, other. She was a curious girl, though, and the wildlife in the hills around Spokane kept her rapt. She pushed herself to read so she could learn more about it. The sawtooth wolf pack, which stalked the mountains of nearby Idaho. By the time her family moved to the Seattle suburb of Mercer Island in the early 2000s, Kaylee Swift could read, had kicked Ritalin, and knew science was her jam. She zeroed in on birds, and corvids in particular, as a biology major at Willamette University in Oregon. She joined Marsliff as a graduate student at UW in 2012. Now she's standing in a back lot of the university on a cloudy April morning holding a dead bird and recreating her most important experiment as perturbed crows orbit, screeching and scolding. It's hard to overstate the intensity of this experience. Nearly 30 banshees freaking out. They're 20 feet above, where they have the advantage of height and numbers, and all their attention and ire is directed at you. The nerve-fraying shrieks blast from every direction. A crow funeral is disorienting, a bit scary, and more than a little awe-inspiring. This morning, the noise has drawn out a university maintenance worker from behind a utility building. He's tall, sports a short white beard, and wears a bright orange safety vest. Is he here to admonish Swift for all the noise? Just a casual, awestruck observer? It's hard to tell. She's had the occasional run-in with angry people during her experiments throughout the city. She's even had the cops called on her. Trying to talk over the din would be pointless, it's so loud. So the man stands there, expressionless. Swift says her funeral study demonstrates how crows process death and then warn one another about potential danger. A dead crow clearly means something bad has happened to the crow. The presence of a potential predator, be it a bobcat, Joe with the soul patch, or Swift walking around on a Thursday, appears to make their warnings all the more urgent. Years ago, Swift will later confess, she bonded with a female crow she had studied on campus, identifiable by its green and orange band. Scientists, of course, are discouraged from connecting emotionally with their subjects, lest it harm their objectivity. But it turned out this crow's territory was Swift's campus-adjacent bus stop. She had named the crow Go. Its partner was Stop. And long after the study was over, Swift began feeding Go while waiting for the bus, where every day the crow waited for her. Go was old, at least 14, Swift estimates. Crows can live up to 20 years. And she admits she became quite attached to the bird. Last July, a colleague informed Swift over email that Go had been found dead on campus. That just sort of, like, broke my heart in such a deep way, Swift said. Loss, of course, is at the core of Swift's funeral study. How do intelligent organisms deal with it? How do we cope? She says that when her grandmother died recently and she attended the funeral, she didn't know what to do with herself. She worried that her clinical view of death, she is, after all, a wildlife biologist, might come out and upset her family. At the same time, Swift treats the deceased participants in her work with dignity not typically associated with scientific research. When she finally covers up the dead crow in today's reenactment of her funeral experiment, it's with a gentle precision, as if the linen were a religious shroud. At that, the birds slowly grow quieter. Without one of their own to mourn, the circle above thins, and some crows retreat to a power line or disappear altogether. Light cawing remains, but a person can now hear herself talk. The orange-vested university maintenance worker, drawn in by the commotion, still stands nearby and is still hard to read. He takes a wary step toward Swift. A kind of, what magic is this, wary step? Before he speaks, he looks up again at the emptying sky and back down at the 30-year-old woman standing in sorrels and placing a dark object into a shopping bag. Did you do all that? This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Seattle Met. There's an interesting business column this week I thought you might like. It's their issue of the week, Volvo's Electric Gamble. Volvo is betting that the future is electric, said Adele Peters in FastCompany.com. Last week, the Swedish firm became the first mainstream car company to commit entirely to electrified vehicles. Starting in 2019, every new Volvo model will run at least partly on electricity. Some will be all-electric cars, while others will be hybrids, which use batteries and electric motors to supplement traditional combustion engines run on gasoline. The standard industry production cycle is 7 years, so Volvo will continue to build and sell diesel and gas-powered cars until about 2025. But as those older models are retired, every vehicle in the Volvo fleet will eventually have an electric motor. By plunging fully into this space, Volvo appears equal parts visionary, zealot, and daredevil, said Ariane Marshall in Wired.com. Despite the buzz, electric vehicles still make up less than 1% of global car sales, and for good reason. Their batteries are still heavy and expensive and provide limited range. Charging infrastructure is still relatively sparse. Here in the U.S., low gas prices blunt the save-on-fuel sales pitch. But look closer, and Volvo's gambit isn't as crazy as it initially seems. Governments around the world are implementing strict new emission standards to fight climate change, with France announcing last week that it will ban sales of diesel and gas vehicles altogether by 2040. Self-driving cars, considered to be the industry's next big thing, also work better with electric motors, which are simpler than combustion engines. This announcement signals nothing about the electric car future and everything about Volvo's niche marketing, said Holman Jenkins Jr. in the Wall Street Journal. The automaker's famous emphasis on safety has long since become the price of admission in the car business, so it needs a new sales angle, and electrification fits the bill. Something else is also going on. Though based in Sweden, Volvo has been under Chinese ownership since 2010. That country has been promoting electric vehicles through aggressive emissions mandates in order to reduce its dependence on foreign oil. And it is now Volvo's biggest market. But where will Chinese drivers get their substitute energy source? Coal-powered electrical plants, not exactly the greenest of solutions. Volvo's move is scary for Tesla, said Leonid Bershidsky in Bloomberg.com. But neither company can rest easy. The market for electric cars is largely government-driven. And when government incentives and tax breaks for electric vehicles dry up, so do sales. It's still too soon to write an obituary for the internal combustion engine, said Brad Plummer in the New York Times. But the march toward electric vehicles is picking up speed. Plug-in hybrids and all-electric cars are projected to make up 54% of new light-duty vehicle sales globally by 2040. Plug-ins are expected to become cost competitive with gas-powered cars between 2025 and 2030, even without subsidies. Once that happens, mass adoption should quickly follow. And we will finish out our show today on the Talking Points page as usual. Here we have Democrats, should they shift to the center? The path back to power for Democrats is to move to the center, said Mark Penn and Andrew Stein in the New York Times. In the second Obama term and during the 2016 primaries, the party lurched to the left, embracing identity politics, class warfare, and big government. Transgender bathroom issues and hostility to police are popular with blue state urbanites, but are poison to working class voters in small towns and rural areas. That's why the Democrats have surrendered Congress, the presidency, and over 1,000 seats in state legislatures in recent years. That shouldn't be surprising. Only about 25% of Americans identify themselves as liberals. We've seen this movie before. After years of leftward drift, Bill Clinton moved the party back to the center in the 1990s, promoting fiscal responsibility, welfare reform, and a sweeping crime bill, and Democrats were back. If they reject socialist ideas and return to the left-of-center pragmatism of Clinton and John F. Kennedy, they can win again. Penn and Stein's thesis is utter fiction, said Richard Esko in HuffingtonPost.com. Democratic losses began not with the lefty lurch, but in 2009 when President Obama tried to reach across the aisle and govern as a centrist. While Bernie Sanders nudged Hillary Clinton's rhetoric leftward last year, her campaign ads shied away from progressive policy issues, and she chose centrist Tim Kaine as her running mate. That worked out well, didn't it? What Penn wants is for Democrats to cater to angry white working class voters who've already fled the party, said Mark Stern in Slate.com. But the Democratic base is diverse and progressive, and the country is changing. Penn blames transgender bathrooms for losses, but a Public Religion Research Institute poll shows 53% of Americans support trans people using the bathroom of their choice. We're not in the 90s anymore. Americans of all stripes have evolved. Nevertheless, Democrats are deeply divided, said Max Ehrenfreund in the Washington Post. There is a raging internal debate over whether it's possible to woo back working-class voters, and there are significant rifts on bread and butter issues such as free trade, free college tuition, and single-payer health care. What do Democrats stand for, aside from opposition to Trump? If they can't agree on a simple and straightforward pitch to voters, they won't be able to expand the tent and put together a winning electoral coalition. And a few of the shorter notes. Millennials have officially overtaken baby boomers as America's largest living generation. Those who are between 18 to 34 years old now number 75.4 million, surpassing the 74.9 million Americans ages 51 to 69. Rival White House advisors Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner each have individual teams of aides working for them, including their own public relations people, who field inquiries and leak stories that help advance their bosses' competing agendas and influence the president. The Israeli military is buying drones modified to hold machine guns, grenade launchers, and other weapons for use in urban warfare. The maker, Florida-based startup Duke Robotics, is also pitching its heavily armed drones to the U.S. military. Before 1800, no country in the world had an average life expectancy at birth beyond 40. Today, there is not a country that does not. And we will finish out the show with a quote. This from Aldous Huxley, quoted in NationalReview.com. He says, "Most human beings have an almost infinite capacity for taking things for granted." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.